In a world filled with war, hate, suffering, and Justin Bieber, two guys fix it all with a battle about a movie. One film, two opinions, one coin, two sides. They feud. You decide. It's time for Film Feud.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Film Feud, the podcast where we debate whether top-rated movies should be top-rated. I'm Vidur.
And I'm Vikram.
What's happening, Vikram?
Hey, Vidur.
Ready to feud today?
Of course.
Why don't you tell the good folk, our beautiful listeners, what we're doing here?
We choose a movie from the IMDb Top 250, heads argues for and tails against. Simple.
That's right. We feud and you, the good folk, our beautiful listeners, get to decide who you think won. You can vote on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and let us know who you think won. Let us know what arguments you might have made, and let us know what movie you might want us to feud next.
That's right. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram under Film Feud Podcast, and on Twitter at Film Feud Pod.
So with that, why don't we get to the movie we're feuding this week, which is Fight Club. One might say we are fighting this week.
Yeah, this is film fight.
Do you realize that by feuding this movie, we're actually breaking the first and second rule of Fight Club?
Well, we kind of have to, don't we?
Well, I'm pretty excited to feud this one because I haven't seen it in at least 10 years. The last time I saw it, I was very young and impressionable. So, you know, the movie left an impact.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and say that I really liked it when I saw it, but that was over 10, 12 years ago. So,
ooh,
who knows?
Pre-coin toss reveal, a rarity on the feud. So you're actually admitting to having liked the movie.
10, 12 years ago, yeah. I was a little boy then, so who knows?
Why don't we get to it? You want to toss the coin and figure out what side we're feuding?
Sure, let's do this. If I get heads, I argue for. If I get tails, I argue against. And I got tails.
You like the movie, remember?
10 years ago, I suddenly have this creeping feeling that I'm not going to anymore.
Yeah, yeah. What a shock. What a shock that you have switched your stance. I can't wait to watch this movie now, knowing that you have to reverse your stance here. It's just beautiful.
I can't wait either. I already know that I'm not going to like it as much as I did 10 years ago. So let's just jump right into the movie. But before we begin our episode, a quick shout out for Hubhopper.
Hubhopper is India's very own podcast app with the largest directory that brings you thousands of unique shows and stories from every imaginable genre.
You can now listen to your favorite podcast, Film Feud, on Hubhopper. That's Hubhopper.
So go ahead and download the Hubhopper app from the Play or App Store today. And if you like it, review it and share it with your friends.
With that, let's go watch the movie.
Let's do it. Oh my God, dude. I had forgotten the genius of this film. This was the perfect time to watch this film. I just know more about the world. I feel like I hadn't absorbed it when I watched it earlier. By the way, I also read the book in the middle, and the book is far inferior to the movie. Oh my God, what has David Fincher done here? No wonder he's considered one of the all-time greats. This alone gets him into the Hall of Fame. Forget everything else. Just this alone.
Can you pass me that Crocin, dude? I have a really bad headache, man.
Oh, can you pass me the Crocin? Is it from me talking on the movie? Just spit it out.
The movie. Your talking isn't helping. I'm going to be honest. But the movie, man, it's so confused in terms of tone and vibe. It's just all over the place. Just came together. Just gave me one big ass headache.
Can you lend me 1,000 rupees?
Sure.
I'm not paying it back, by the way. I'm considering it asshole tax.
Oh.
My favorite line from the movie applies here like none other.
Well done.
What are you talking about? You just have to say it, right? Now it gave you a headache. Defend the headache. You can't just say it gave me a headache.
I have the perfect defense for the headache. The intro credits. Do you remember the intro credits?
Badass. And now a David Fincher phenomenon. Like some crazy techno rock, some crazy visuals. Amazing.
Crazy techno rock has to be good crazy techno rock, not bad crazy techno rock. And with the whole brain synapses moving along, it gave me a teaser of the shock I was about to witness and just downhill from there.
Are we feuding Cyberpunk right now? Are we feuding the opening credits right now? Are we feuding Fight Club right now?
We're feuding Fight Club, which includes the opening credits of Fight Club.
I thought it was fun. In fact, the visual effects in this movie overall, kind of jumping ahead here, they're pretty good for 1999, man. They do all these funky like in camera, in from CGI to real life to CGI, stylistic stuff that's really cool. And that one scene where Edward Norton's apartment is being filled with IKEA furniture is pretty crazy for the time in 1999.
I remember the scene you're talking about. That scene was okay. I mean, 1999 was also the year Matrix came out, so we know where we were in terms of special effects capabilities. One particular event in the movie which was pretty cool in terms of CGI was, if you remember when Edward Norton was imagining another plane crashing into his plane,
yeah,
that five second sequence, that was pretty cool in terms of special effects. But overall, the movie, I didn't feel it that much.
Actually, that segment was from the book. And that's one great example of how the movie surpasses the book, because reading that on the page can feel whatever it feels. But watching that in the movie, the one plane crashing into another, which is happening in the narrator's head, that was so visceral and raw and done so well. By the way, how we got stuck in the weeds here? I kind of blame myself because I was really excited.
You started it.
Let's just talk broadly, man. This movie is just magnificent. I mean, David Fincher plus this book, it's just stylistically so well done. It's also very like kinetic. It's just constantly moving. Crazy things are happening. You're also living inside this person's head, and then you're watching this crazy plot. This movie is a trip. It's like this violent meditation on all the different themes it's covering, like consumerism and masculinity and obviously dissociative identity disorder. Blew my mind like none other. David Fincher plus this book equals magic.
Okay, why don't you tell me what you liked about what David Fincher did here?
I just did. Didn't you see my emotional reaction? That's all David Fincher. But obviously, how stylistically good this movie is, he actually really fought to get this movie made at the budget that it was made. And the kind of technical marvel which he's now known for, computer graphics, the production values that he brought together, along with, of course, Edward Norton, who was considered the Robert De Niro of the time, and Brad Pitt, who was, you know, the Brad Pitt of his time, just brought that all together to create this movie. It's just amazing.
I like how you brute forced a comparison between De Niro and Edward Norton in there.
I didn't brute force anything. Apparently,
you can just say it and make it true. It doesn't work like that way.
He was known in the 90s to be the next Bobby De Niro. What can I do? That's just the reputation he had.
Sadly, he didn't become it.
I'm not saying it panned out, but I'm saying the potential hadn't died during this movie for sure.
I'm generally not a big fan of David Fincher. I obviously, when the first time I saw this movie, I didn't know who Fincher was and that he'd made this movie. So that had zero impact into my, well, liking this movie when I watched it for the first time. And then when I saw it again, I think after the movie was made is when I realized that it was David Fincher. And it kind of makes sense.
What do you mean it made sense?
I think he's very overhyped.
I would be willing to consider that opinion if you start taking his future filmography after Fight Club into account. You know, I like a lot of them. I like The Social Network a lot. I like Zodiac. But yeah, he didn't knock it out of the park with all of them. But at least until this point, the way he did little things in the movie just blew my mind, right? So he had these asides where he was actually incorporating a very Tarantino-esque style, fourth wall breaking. Like, for instance, when they're going through how to insert pornography into film reels, completely break the fourth wall, they're talking to the audience. It actually reminded me of that Tarantino sequence from Inglourious Basterds when he's explaining how film reel can be made into an explosive. And the way it all builds towards the twist, all the foreshadowing, I'm sure we'll talk about the twist. It was just so well executed. Hence, David Fincher equals legend.
Genius. What genius, man.
Oh, thanks. You're conceding. I appreciate it.
I'm obviously not conceding here. I'm being sarcastic, if you can't make out. Talking specifically about his movies up until Fight Club only, the only good movie that he'd done up until that point was Seven, which I happen to like. I think it's a great movie.
Good.
Yeah, it was a great movie, and it had a lot to do with the writing of the movie and, of course, the actors, Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt, who was not playing the typical Brad Pitt, which I feel like he's playing in this movie. He actually played a character which was a little subdued, a little more emotional.
Just because Brad Pitt himself happens to be the embodiment of everything masculine doesn't mean that it's his fault when he plays a character, Tyler Durden.
Dude,
that's also that.
That title belongs to George Clooney, by the way.
No, that doesn't. At least in the 90s, Brad Pitt was the embodiment of everything masculine. And, great casting then, you can say, right?
My point being that he made a good movie in 7. He'd made Aliens 3, which is horrible, obviously. And then he made The Game between 7 and Fight Club. I hope you haven't seen The Game. If you haven't, then don't even attempt it. And then he made Fight Club. And he got a lot of things wrong with this movie. And I feel like that has a lot to do with the support he had in place. As compared to 7, where he had a way better editor, he had a better scriptwriter in place. Here it was someone else who just vanished into thin air post this movie as well. So I understand the reasoning behind his need to make more movies, but you can see that he's still very amateurish in this movie.
Dude, the guy made me get on board with a talking penguin in a cave that represents the man cave. What more do you want from a guy?
You like that?
I love the talking penguin. It's out there. It's weird. The movie's weird. It's like you're inside someone's head. It's like, this is before Charlie Kaufman, who started writing movies like Eternal Sunshine and Synecdoche, New York. This is before he became a thing, right? So this was Chuck Palahniuk's book where you're going inside somebody's mind who's almost by definition psychotic. So what does that look like? A talking penguin is just another part of it. It's weird. Embrace the weird, my friend. Life is weird. The inside of a head is weird. This movie is weird in the best way possible.
I cannot. The penguin, I cannot. I just cannot get myself to.
Your face is weird. Your mom is weird. Just embrace the weird.
Talking a little bit more about the book, I didn't know that you'd read it. I haven't read it myself. And what I understand from the book is that it was written as a satire. And the tricky thing about satire is, if it doesn't feel like satire, which this doesn't according to me, it feels like the thing that is being satirized, right? And which in this case is consumerism, stick it to the man, the machine, and you know, do all those things, which is shown in this movie by just dudes fighting and, you know, this undertone of not being a slave to the corporation, which keeps getting lost and comes back whenever the script demands it. I didn't feel it as a satire at all and just fell flat in that sense.
You know what I'm feeling from you right now?
What?
The fact that you're a slave to the man and consumerism and you're not able to actually break free of it and recognize all the themes this movie is trying to make you recognize. At the end of the day, a fight club, two guys fighting, it's just the narrator's manifestation of understanding what it means to be a man, right? To completely break down, to start from zero, to forget everything society lays on top of you, your wallet, your house, your name, your credit card, your business card. And then it's just two guys fighting, or sometimes it's just one guy beating the shit out of himself.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't feel like blowing up a credit card company building, man. It's not my fault.
Can we just talk about that? Here's my only concession. I think maybe 1999 was a different world, but I don't understand how blowing up credit card company headquarters will actually result in losing all credit card information. I know cloud computing wasn't a thing, but I'm pretty sure servers used to exist back then.
Also, just pre-9/11, no movie's going to show that way again, ever.
That's true. But by the way, the ending of the book was totally different. This was probably the biggest difference. It turns out after the narrator discovers that he himself is Tyler Durden and shoots himself in the cheek, he just kind of wakes up in a mental asylum, which he describes as heaven. But you know from the description that it's actually a mental asylum. And Tyler Durden's minions, through Project Mayhem, actually go and execute their plan outside the mental asylum. And then it's kind of like this whole Tyler Durden will return one day vibe at the ending.
Interesting. I did not know that. And that actually sounds like a way better ending than this movie's ending. Speaking of, slow clap. Slow clap for that ending, man.
It was out there. Firstly, what helped the ending was that Pixies song. What's it called again?
Where Is My Mind?
Ooh, so appropriate.
Oh, you were waiting for me to set that up, weren't you?
I actually did not remember the name of the song. But the Pixies song helped. It reminded me of The Matrix, which ends with Wake Up, right?
Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah, yeah. I know, I'm conceding the ending, right? It's kind of out there. It didn't really make too much sense, especially the first time I watched it. Now I understand it's more symbolic or metaphorical because Marla becomes the center of this narrator's story. It becomes the arc because she's the one who becomes the inciting incident for him to actually split into Tyler Durden as well in a way. And then when he finally gets her is right around the time when he melds those personalities back by shooting himself in the cheek. I know it doesn't make too much sense. And then they watch the world burn together and they hold hands. It's nice, isn't it?
No. Not at all. Explain me this. He shoots himself in the cheek and Brad Pitt dies? And also Brad Pitt dies. Why is he dying the way he dies? With the whole smoke coming out of the face. What is that I taste? What's
happening? It's a movie. It's a movie.
Oh, all of a sudden it's a movie? Well, up until then, oh my God, what a commentary of like social consumer.
I don't get it. I'm conceding it, right? I'm conceding it. And by the way, like when you make a, at the time, $63 million movie in Hollywood, you need a Hollywood ending. That's just the way things were. If David Fincher was to make this today, firstly, he would make it on Netflix. And secondly, he would not have this ending. It would probably be even more out there.
That's an assumption, man. I feel like nothing would have changed.
I feel like you're wrong. Now?
I feel like I wasted 2 hours of my life, and so did you.
Ooh, wow.
With your feet on the air, your head up your ass.
Is that the Pixies song?
That's this movie.
Wow, sick burn, bro. Like the burn on the narrator's hand. Callback.
Just talking about narration, man. Top 2 worst narration jobs in a movie ever.
What? That's a ridiculous opinion.
It was horrible, man. It made no sense. He's just using narration to just make the story move forward without any semblance of a script or tying into the story at all. It made no sense.
Firstly, it's the inner monologue, right? And I know that the conventional screenwriting thing is to not have narration because it's weak. But in this case, this is about some guy with split personalities who ends up talking to himself a lot and insomnia. So it made a lot of sense. Also, what do you mean top two? What's the other one?
Have you seen George of the Jungle?
Yes, I love George of the Jungle.
Oh,
I mean,
go watch it again.
I mean, I loved it when I watched it.
I had a chance to watch it recently and oh my God.
So you're hating on the narration from George of the Jungle.
And this movie.
While admitting that you watched it recently. I mean, that's the real news story here.
Circumstances, man. Circumstances. That's all I'm going to say to
And
that.
That's not a waste of 2 hours of your life.
It was a bigger waste. I'll agree to that. But
didn't that movie have talking apes?
Yeah, that movie had a lot of stuff.
English
there.
Talking apes.
Let's not get into that movie right now.
And you're comparing it to Fight Club for the narration.
I am. I'll give you an example of the narration, which really pissed me off, right? He's the story's progressing, the characters are getting developed and stuff, and all of a sudden he's like, oh wait, let me back up. For 6 months, I couldn't sleep. Boom. Oh, character has insomnia. What a way to tell the audience.
That's a very standard opening. What are you bitching about and moaning about? It's just very standard to open it with the cliffhanger, then go back and be like, okay, here's the story. Wait, you know who else did it? Goodfellas did exactly that. Now what? Now what are you going to do? Are you going to hate on Goodfellas narration?
For me.
What? Goodfellas narration did the same thing. It opens with the shot of them burying that mobster.
They show them burying that mobster.
And then they go back and he says, ever since I was a child, I wanted to be a gangster.
Yeah.
What? What
There's
do you mean?
Such a big difference between these two points.
No, the difference is that you lost a coin toss.
No, the narration in Goodfellas is introducing the story and then the story is shown. Here it's like, how do I tell the audience that I have insomnia? Oh, let me just tell them. Oh, let me back up. For 6 months I couldn't sleep. That makes no sense.
It's like Dunkirk. They just set the thing that you need to know
Dude,
in like
stop,
written words.
Stop throwing in good movies into the mix just to compare them with this movie.
There's a reason this movie is so high on the IMDb. Clearly everybody feels the same
IMDb
way.
IMDb messed up. That's the reason.
Forget everything else. The acting in this movie. Just the powerhouse of talent. I mean, forget the comparisons to Robert De Niro. But Edward Norton was fresh off Primal Fear, where he also played someone with split personality, although he was faking it in that movie. Spoilers. And you know, this was also the same time he did Rounders. So just that era of Edward Norton, I just respected so much. He was on a spree.
Yeah, it was Edward Norton when he was bad.
He was bad in Rounders also now.
Yeah, he was pretty bad in Rounders. Come on.
Such a crybaby, dude. And Brad Pitt.
See, there's this Brad Pitt character, which Brad Pitt played for like 10 years straight. Which is called Brad Pitt. And
name other movies where he supposedly played Brad Pitt.
The Mexican, all the Oceans movies. It's just this one suave, slick Brad Pitt. It's boring, honestly. It's just, there's nothing fresh about it.
You can't have it both ways. You can't complain about it and then also say that he made a mistake. Tyler Durden is suave, slick, perfect.
Marry him, won't you?
I would if I could, man. There's a reason Mala was so into him.
Can we talk about Mala for a second?
Helena Bonham Carter and all her glory.
She's made for quirky roles, man. Why doesn't she just keep doing Alice in Wonderland, Harry Potter, Bellatrix, Lestrange roles? She can't play a normal, well, not a normal human being, but a human being.
Marla wasn't a normal human being. That's the whole point.
I feel like Marla's character was, well, we can't blame Carter for this because she's been given a script and she's enacting it out. But Marla's character, the way it was written and the way, again, I'm not commenting on the book or what it would have been in the book. Let's just talk about this movie specifically. But her character in this movie is... the only word I can think of is convenient, right? She comes out of nowhere smoking cigarettes in cancer group meetings and then just strutting around, disrupting the narrator's life. And then she's gone for a good chunk of the movie and then she comes back and then she's gone again and she's back in the ending. I don't understand the character. Like, I want to appreciate her character more. I can't. Like, can you help me with that?
Well, maybe she didn't have too much of an arc, or maybe she was just a sort of catalyst for the other characters, which happens to be just one character, to actually get to their story. So she becomes the inciting incident to split into Tyler Durden. Then she becomes the sort of person who he resents himself as in Tyler Durden with. And then also she becomes the person through which you get a lot of hints and foreshadowing, which you can only appreciate on the second watch. Like when she asks him, how did you get here so fast? When she asks him, who are you talking to? When Tyler is talking to Edward Norton. Or she asks him, like, what do you mean us? Every time Edward Norton keeps referring to him and Tyler as us. I love how acerbic and witty she is. Like when Edward Norton finally gathers the balls to confront her and tell her not to come to his meetings. He just says, like, I saw you at that other meeting. And she's like, I saw you practicing this speech, confronting me. Shit like that just made it very natural.
I don't buy that, man. I think they should have done a better job in terms of fleshing out the character of Marla in this movie, and it would have been a much better watch. And I like Carter as an actor. She's a good actor. She does justice to whatever weird dimensions of roles she's given. But it didn't feel like that in this movie. It just felt forced. It felt very convenient in terms of her character placement within the script. And I don't know, man. I didn't like it at all.
She was instrumental to actually holding on to what's happening in the movie. And also the twist. She was instrumental to the twist.
She was present in the twist.
Can we talk about the twist?
Yeah, let's talk about the twist.
Up there, don't you think? The twist, greatest, one of the greatest twists of all time in Hollywood?
I think the greatest twist of all time is The Sixth Sense.
Okay, that one's pretty up there. But unlike The Sixth Sense, this twist actually changes everything you've been watching about the movie thematically. Not just in terms of, oh my god, Bruce Willis was dead all along, and then you go and work out whether the movie lived up to that twist or not. This just changes what the movie has been trying to show so far. It adds a whole different context to everything that's happened in the movie so far.
I don't think so, man. I think the twist in The Sixth Sense has a much greater impact in terms of the viewing experience. And also in terms of this movie particularly, the timing of the twist, it sort of happens midway or during the beginning of the third act. I feel like it should have been closer to the ending, and it should have taken away the shock value from whatever that ending was. I think they should have placed more value on the twist then.
I so disagree. Placing value on the twist is exactly what I'm ranting against. That's what Shyamalan did throughout the first like 90% of his career. And that's what just sunk him. Because a twist should lead to something, right? So after he figures out that he's Tyler Durden, the narrator actually tries to undo what he did. He then has to realize that everybody around him is actually already part of Project Mayhem. That's such a fun sequence when he goes to the police and half the cops end up being part of Project Mayhem. And then also you find out that Tyler has essentially taken steps for when eventually the narrator figures out that they're the same person, and that's why the cops try to like kill him. So all that is a very instrumental part of the movie. He's fighting against himself.
That chunk of the film is definitely the weakest part of the entire movie. I think post the twist happening, the script sort of unraveled, the direction unraveled. They were sort of grasping at straws in terms of how to make it seem natural or as natural as the film had progressed up until that point. And they couldn't hold it together. And then it culminated with that, just that stupid ass ending, man.
I'm surprised at how you haven't even conceded anything. You have to concede something. What about the part of the movie?
I conceded that 5-second sequence.
Which sequence?
The airplane one. Airplanes banging into each other.
I would count a 5-second concession if you concede the talking penguin.
No chance. You'll have to kill me for that one.
What about the whole aspect of the movie that kind of speaks to how cults are formed? That was my favorite part in terms of the themes, because I realized only maybe halfway into the movie that that's what they're actually showing, like how a cult is formed. Kind of like Paul Thomas Anderson did with The Master, except that was too real, right? Because it completely followed the path of a religion that we shall not name, but let's just say certain actors in Mission Impossible are a member of said religion / cult. But unlike The Master, this was again showing it satirically. And when Fight Club became Project Mayhem, that's when it's the most obvious. Like, they're making these kids who want to join go through 3 days of torture and punishment, standing outside without food or shelter. And then once that kid gets in, he's doing it to other people. And the way it propagates, like for instance, when Bob, who by the way is Meatloaf, did you know Bob is Meatloaf?
I did not.
That's Meatloaf in a fat suit. And when Bob dies and he says his name is Robert Paulson, the narrator just says it, right? It's just a sentence. And then everybody starts chanting it. Or they say like, oh, in death, we are allowed to have our names back. It's all this like rules that are just forming very, very typical cult behavior. I thought that was a very cool aspect of the movie.
I see what you're saying in terms of what they were trying to show or what they were trying to do, especially with this whole cult forming or just the overall messaging of, you know, sticking it to the man. But why they do all of this is the thing that's not clear. And that's the essence of all of these reasons. For example, how is the movie sticking it to capitalism by inserting porno clips in family movies or planning to destroy a square block of buildings? How is this messaging clear? I didn't get it at all. And why do they start a fight club again exactly?
To fight?
What? It makes no sense. I mean, do you remember that step, that fundamental scene of them starting the fight club, which is just outside that bar?
Yeah, of course.
When they first met. So Edward Norton's asking Brad Pitt if he can stay at his house. And Brad Pitt says yes, walks away, comes back and says, punch me as hard as you can. What? Where'd that come from?
It came from him internally, firstly, as is clear at the end of the movie. Why they are fighting, why they start a fight club. It's just all about tapping into your inner masculinity, breaking down yourself in a way that you don't when you live in society otherwise. Now, I might not understand all themes of the movie, but this is definitely part of it, right? Like Tyler Durden keeps saying, it's only when you get down to nothing, it's only when you lose everything is when you can achieve something. Again, I'm paraphrasing. So why it happens in that moment is clearly just something that's been inside the narrator all along, right? It just manifests itself in that moment. It's his inner conscience, which becomes a split personality, telling him to do something. And unlike him, it doesn't hesitate. It just kind of jumps to it, right? And you know the funny part about that scene is that Edward Norton and Brad Pitt were supposed to hit each other, with Edward Norton hitting Brad Pitt first because he says, punch me. And Edward Norton was told by David Fincher to actually hit Brad Pitt to get the most honest reaction. And so he hits Brad Pitt, catches him on the ear, which was not something that's supposed to happen. And Brad Pitt actually, of course, as an amazingly trained actor, goes with the scene. And he just goes, oh my God, you hit me on the ear. And that's the take they use in the movie. It just came out of surprise. He actually hit him and it's a real reaction.
Have these guys heard of MMA?
Yeah, MMA was around in the 90s.
It's pretty big in the 90s, man.
People... Yeah, but it didn't happen in your house basement. You couldn't start a cult off it, right?
I guess, but they talk about the people who gravitate towards the club initially, you know, the great minds who pump gas and work dead-end jobs, and they're pissed off at the man, so they fight and, you know, get their release. It's just a bunch of existential mumbo-jumbo, dude.
The funny thing about this is it probably became a great ad for the MMA, like just viscerally, gutturally, why people should watch and maybe join the MMA. But then now, if you think about what this movie is trying to represent with its fighting, especially with the anti-consumerism, sticker-to-the-man thing, the UFC, which is probably the most famous MMA entity there is now like a multi-billion dollar corporation and pretty much represents the man. It charges pay-per-view just to watch essentially what Fight Club was offering. Which actually brings me to an interesting question that's asked in the movie. If you could fight any celebrity, who would it be?
You mean fight or feud?
Feud any celebrity. That's interesting. Okay, if you could feud any celebrity, who would it be?
I would love to feud The Rock.
Dwayne Johnson, The Rock?
I would whoop his candy ass.
You're talking about feuding, not fighting, right?
I am, of course, talking about feuding and not fighting.
I don't know, man. He's out there like doing a lot of these PR things. He seems pretty good. He does those things with Kevin Hart where he actually trades insults. I think he'd whoop your ass. Just like he whoops asses in everything he does.
Nah, man. Firstly, it's candy ass. When you're talking about The Rock, you never say ass. And I'm going to whoop his candy ass. What about you?
If I could feud any celebrity? I'd have to think about that. I think... Well, I'm very competitive, firstly. So I'd be aiming to win. And...
Pussy. Just gonna pick someone inferior to yourself, aren't you?
I was actually going to pick someone mute. And then I realized that'd be a little insensitive. So I'd have to go with Stephen Hawking.
Wow, I think Stephen Hawking would kill you, dude.
Firstly, rest in peace, Stephen Hawking. And secondly, I never said what stage in Stephen Hawking's life I would actually feud
convenient.
Him.
So you'd feud a five-year-old Stephen Hawking would whoop your ass.
Just generically, Stephen Hawking is the person I would choose to feud. It would be very stimulating, if nothing else.
Right, right.
It'd be better than feuding you. Do you know how much you've pissed me off during this episode? It's getting ridiculous.
You know what? I found out something about you today, Vidur. I now know what you sound like when you have an explanation ready for something you truly don't feel anything about, i.e. how good this movie is.
That's so rude of you, by the way.
I'm getting to know you better. I'm glad. I'm happy this is happening.
That's a big insinuation you're making there. This is how I truly feel about this movie, okay? And by the way, I saw you practicing this rant in the corner.
Right, right. Well played, well played. You know, one thing I want to talk to you about is how the entire team behind this movie, the directors, the writers, and the actors, they kept referring to The Graduate whenever they spoke about this movie in terms of how this was a coming-of-age movie.
It just spoke to a certain sort of age bracket at the time, the way The Graduate did.
But that's absolute bull, isn't it? Constant repetition of something doesn't make it true, does it, Mr. Trump?
Jesus. Very political of you, Vikram, but fine, I'm willing to hear you out.
This movie has nothing in common with The Graduate, man. The book might be a coming-of-age story, so mistakenly the director or the writers thought this movie would be as well. But it isn't. It's what they perceive as a very current outlook to life in general and just shoehorn this existential mumbo-jumbo into it. And it doesn't feel like coming-of-age at all. It's a mishmash of various themes that come off as pseudo-intellectual and just confused.
Just like The Graduate.
I didn't think so. I thought The Graduate was a really good movie.
Actually, I'm not sure why I said that. I mean, okay, fine. I grant you that. I don't know what's that in common with The Graduate. They both had great music. That's one thing that's common. I think The Graduate was just about a guy who was also trapped in a way, right? Like, Dustin Hoffman's character was just someone who had what society demanded him to have, and he was figuring out what's more. And so he got into some screwed up relationships. Why am I trying to defend this? I don't care. Okay, so they compare it to The Graduate and doesn't hold up. Why have you trapped me into this? What are we, high school debaters?
It's just a point I wanted to raise and see what explanation you could come up with. And now I see.
Okay, great. A point I wanted to raise was that if I had a tumor, I would name it Vikram. See, the dialogues in this movie are so good.
Everything in this movie, I feel, is just brutally inserted so that the story progresses how it's supposed to. There's no nuance anywhere. He just calls up Tyler Durden by saying he has no reason to call him. There's a forced fight outside a bar. He finds journals about I am Jack so-and-so, so that becomes a theme in the movie. Marla keeps coming in and out whenever there's convenient plot points involved. It just upset me how bad this movie was and how good I thought it was when I first watched it. And to summarize my thoughts, it just makes me upset that there'll be movies in the future that I'll have to watch which I thought were good because of the show. And I hate you, Vidur.
Oh, wow. You hate me. Ooh, hurtful. We have now learned what a cog in the machine of the man you are. And we definitely know between the two of us who's the Tyler Durden and who's the pussy Edward Norton narrator, insomniac loser.
Who wins in the end.
Who shoots himself in the cheek in the end.
And in my updated summary, Mr. Robot did it better.
You're such a dick for having the last word with saying that, you bastard.
So that was this week's episode of Film Feud. Hope you guys enjoyed.
I'm too pissed off to even thank the listeners for listening right now. You just riled me up. I'm ready to fight you, by the way. Bare knuckle.
Just suck it up and thank them, will you?
Thanks for listening, guys.
Now we feuded, and you guys get to decide who won this feud. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram under Film Feud Podcast or on Twitter at Film Feud Pod. The polls are going to be up there.
Don't forget to find us on iTunes and leave us a review or rating if you enjoyed what you heard. And of course, if you listen anywhere else, Stitcher, Castbox, Google Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts.
Till then, see you guys next week.
Bye-bye.